You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Today we're joined again by Alan Blackman, live in the studio. We can't have Marcus Jones at the moment, so unless you want to put on a bit of a British accent.
Don't tempt me. Oh my goodness.
But we've got some exciting stuff on the show today. As we mentioned before, last week's Tonga eruption was a very explosive one, and obviously it had massive impact. Mm-hmm. New research is emerging that shows just how powerful this blast really was.
Yeah. I mean, any volcano you think of being big when they erupt, but this one was enormous on the grand scale of things. And so people, as you say, are busy trying to figure out just how enormous it was. So the things that they do know, for example, is that debris was up to around about 40 kilometres in height, up into the atmosphere, which is enormous. And so NASA have been looking at, obviously, satellite images, et cetera, of these sorts of things, and they have estimated that the amount of energy that was released in the actual explosion was somewhere between 5 and 30 megatons equivalent of TNT, okay? 5 to 30 million tons equivalent of TNT.
Goodness. Oh, my God.
So to put that into perspective, and for some reason, this is what everything gets compared to, I guess, in terms of explosions, is the Hiroshima atomic bomb. So that was 15 kilotons, 15,000 tons, okay? So we're talking somewhere in the scale of 300 to 2,000 times more energy released in this explosion than there was in the Hiroshima bomb, which is utterly
massive.
Ridiculous. Yeah. Nature is scary sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very sadly, there are currently the 3 deaths in Tonga, and there's 2 in Peru, believe it or not, from tsunami that was generated by the explosion. So at the moment, I expect that the death toll is going to rise. Mm. There's been photos, before and after photos in the media of Tonga, satellite photos. And we were there about 4 years ago, lovely sort of beach resort up on the sort of northwest of the island. And it's just gone. I mean, there's before and after photos. There's nothing there.
It's shocking,
and
isn't it?
All the houses
so
and everything just gone. So, you know, you poor people in Tonga, it's got to be tough. In terms of the science, so yes, there were tsunamis, and tsunamis in the water, but also, really interestingly, in the air as well. And if you get a chance to look online, you'll see this fantastic infrared image of this circular wave just spreading out from Tonga and going right around the world. And really fascinatingly, so obviously this affected the air pressure all the way around the world. So once people knew that this was happening, all these amateur meteorologists were out there with their barometers and stuff like that, and they could track the wave as it went through their place.
Oh my goodness.
So they would see the pressure. They would see the pressure wave going around, and really and honestly, do get online and have a look at it, because it just looks like ripples in a pond. It's just really quite
amazing.
Spectacular. And the interesting thing about this wave is that it's a two-dimensional wave, as it hugs the surface of the Earth. Now, normally, if you've got an explosion, say in the air, like, you know, fireworks or something like that, that's a big three-dimensional explosion. It
goes in all directions.
But when we're talking about these sort of explosions of volcanoes and stuff like that, they are two-dimensional and they hug the surface of the Earth. They don't go into the third dimension, presumably, and I'm sort of guessing here, just because of the mere weight of the atmosphere. It's you know, we don't think of the atmosphere as having any weight, but it's pressing down on us with an enormous force. And so this sort of forces the waves to go out sideways, and they form these perfect circles, spherical waves that go all around the Earth.
Just completely flat.
Yep. And so this went around the world in around about 35 or so hours, roughly.
Wow.
And it was traveling at about the speed of sound. So, you know, it's hoofing around there.
Mm.
And really interestingly, this was actually predicted way back in the 19th century, as many things were, by a French dude by the name of Pierre-Simon de Laplace. Now, those of you who have done any sort of maths or physics or something, you might recognize that last name, Laplace.
Mm-hmm.
He is a famous mathematician, but he predicted these sorts of waves. And the first example of the confirmation of that prediction was the very famous eruption of Krakatoa way back in 1883, where that was an island in what is now today Indonesia, and that just basically disappeared. There was an enormous blast.
Wow. Yeah.
And so... This is what science can do, you know. This is I guess a manifestation of science and the predictive power of science and everything. And doesn't make life any easier for the people in Tonga. And you know, obviously, we're all thinking of you. So
yeah, absolutely.
Hopefully things are not as bad there as they look at the moment. But by crikey, yeah, what an enormous,
pretty scary. Those images, really, really awful.
Yeah.
Just a small question that I've got on that. Obviously, you talked about the difference between Hiroshima and this volcano.
Yeah.
Are most volcanoes, when they erupt like that, to that sort of extent of being released?
Yeah, they will be. They're enormous. I mean, the biggest one sort of in my life, or the biggest two, I guess, there was Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in sort of the 90s, and there was Mount St. Helens.
There's been a lot of states.
And again, the video of that is extraordinary. The whole mountainside just slips and then it's gone. You know, so you're talking phenomenal amounts of energy. And again, I think sort of satellite photos showed that before this one blew up in Tonga, it got flooded. And so you can imagine sort of cold water on very, very, very hot magma.
Yeah.
You can imagine that's going to not be a good mix. Mm. So, yeah.
It's really hard to kind of just process the scale.
I know. Yeah. I know. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. You like use those numbers and you're like, wow, that's a lot. Yep. Like, I know that's a lot, but it's,
but it's a lot.
Yeah. On a lighter note, so this new topic is related to genetics, and this one is quite surprising. Researchers have found a link between men's smoking before puberty and then their descendants have a higher percentage of body fat.
Yeah, I know. So, first of all, you sort of wonder how some research studies come to be. So who would have sort of thought, oh, I'll see if there's a link between prepubescent cigarette smoking and body fat.
It's kind of like a study that's born out of it.
Going around asking their friends, going like, so did you smoke before puberty?
Exactly.
Like, are your kids, like, you know, like, what? That's just so strange.
Well, it's actually been shown. This is a study that has been done, and it's just been published this week from people at the University of Bristol. And, you know, as you said, what they found seems to be that there is some sort of a link between the time when your parents or grandparents or great-grandparents took up smoking and your percentage of body fat, which is
amazing.
You know, really quite bizarre. Now, this arises from a study that's called, I think, Children of the 90s, I think, in the UK. Now, again, we've got a similar thing in New Zealand. We've got the Dunedin study, the famous Dunedin
Growing
study from 1973. It's called the Dunedin study.
It's amazing.
And all the kids who were born in Dunedin in 1973, they've monitored them right through their lives.
Yeah.
And
it's incredible.
Yeah.
I did an interview on it last year. If you're interested, do check out bfm.com, 95bfm.com. But it is a fascinating study, and they're still studying this group
of
people.
Absolutely, they are. Yeah. The cohort's fantastic. So.
Yeah.
And they're all adults now. Crazy.
And so this study in the UK, so these are kids born in the 1990s, around about 14,000 children in this study. And what they found, okay, so they did some research back in 2014 that they published, and they said that if a father had started smoking before puberty, and they said that puberty was 11 years of age, then his sons, but not his daughters, had more body fat than usual.
So there seemed to be some
sort of correlation then. And now what they've gone and done is they've extended the study to not only include the fathers, but also the grandfathers and the great-grandfathers. And so now as a result of that study, what they found was that the grandfathers and the great-grandfathers, if they started smoking at an age less than 13, then their female descendants, okay, so the female descendants of the grandfathers and the great-grandfathers, they end up having more body fat than those whose grandfathers and great-grandfathers started smoking between 13 and 16. So that's the comparison then.
Right.
So seemingly the earlier you started smoking, the more intergenerational these effects are. And that's quite extraordinary.
Have they found sort of why that, is it a genetic change? Well, surely it has to be some sort of...
No, you're absolutely right. I'm sure it has to be a genetic change. If it's manifesting itself over two or three generations, it's got to be something.
Mutated, some sort of genetic... thing for Crazy. Body fat. It's so bizarre.
And, you know, having said that, how they managed to isolate this particular variable from all of the other possible variables that are out there.
Yeah, that could have caused
exactly.
that.
Exactly, yeah. I don't know. I'm not an expert on statistics by any means whatsoever. But, you know, those are what have been published. Those are the results that have been published.
Amazing.
And as is usual, more study is necessary, I think. Yes. So, yeah.
What a great starting point.
Totally.
Very
fascinating stuff.
Info.
Yep. Yes.
Yep.
So we do have time for one more topic today.
Cool, okay.
For all the chess fans out there, anyone who watched Queen's Gambit and immediately bought a chess board, you might find this one quite interesting. So there's a maths problem that is 150 years old, and it's relating to the number of queens on a chessboard, but it might have finally been solved after a century and a half.
Right.
Tell us more.
So those of you who know anything about chess will know that the queen is the most powerful piece on the board.
Yes.
And she can move straight ahead or to the side or diagonally.
Yes.
Okay, so that makes her extremely powerful. Now, the problem was first posed back in, I think, 1848, I think they said. And the question is, if you've got eight queens on a normal chessboard, which is 8x8, how many possible ways are there of arranging those queens so that none of them are attacking each other directly? So, in other words, you can't have another queen on the same row or the same the rank or the file or the diagonal.
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
That seems quite impossible.
You might be amazed to know there's 92 ways of doing that.
Oh my goodness.
And that surprises me. 92.
It seems like it would just be
ways.
One.
I can't even think of one. I'm thinking zero.
So there's 92 different possible ways of doing that. Now, not content with having found the answer to that, and that took sort of a couple of years, way back in sort of the 1840s, 1850s or whatever, then they said, okay, well, let's not restrict ourselves to an 8x8 chessboard. What about an N by N chessboard with N queens on it?
Right.
Where N is any positive integer.
Yeah.
Now, if you go N equals 2 and N equals 3, you can't do it. You can't put three queens on a 3x3 chessboard. Doesn't work. N equals 4, greater. You can do it, okay?
Wow.
The question then is, how many different ways can you do it?
Right.
And it's quite easy to figure out sort of for small numbers. You can do it by brute force and stuff like that. But what happens if you want to know, if you've got a million queens on a million by million chessboard, how many possible ways of it? Now, this is what mathematicians do for
Why does it matter? But good for them.
I don't know, in like the 1840s, okay. I don't know if there's much else to do.
Why does it matter? Okay, so to the guy who just spent 5 years doing this, I think it matters quite I think it matters quite a lot.
Really. Sounds amazing. Yeah.
So he's a postdoc at Harvard, and his name is Michael Simkin, and he has just come out with an approximation, seemingly, to this problem. And he's found a quite a simple equation after 48 pages of proof.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And basically the answer is, if you've got an N by N chessboard, then you've got 0.143 times N to the power of N ways of arranging those queens so that they're not attacking each other. Okay, so to give you some idea, again, we're talking big numbers before in the explosion.
And that's so mean that you could just drop any number in there and that would work. Is that sort of the idea? Well, anything above four and above three.
Potentially, there's, as usual, more to it than that. Yeah. But so if you've got, let's say, a million queens on a million by million chessboard, then the answer, the different number of possible ways that you've got is a number that's got 5 million digits to it. Million digits.
My gosh.
Those are the different possible.
Hard to process.
Yeah. I know it is. It's too big. You can't wrap your head around it.
I can't even really imagine a chessboard so big. Because I'm like, are you keeping them like little mini chess, like normal chess, or are you doing giant chess? Because if it's giant chess,
across
it would be
massive.
Country. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. If you've got just a normal chessboard, 8x8 with eight queens on it, there's over 4 billion possible ways that you can arrange those queens. 4 billion.
That's
And of
amazing.
Those, only 92 are unique in which they're not attacking each other. So this, you, you ask, why do you do it? This is a thing called number theory. I think part of maths called number theory, and people do this, and I find it fascinating. You know, all these big numbers, it's just amazing. And, you know, that keeps the mathematicians off the streets, I guess. I don't know. I don't know.
Keeps them in Harvard and doing some more maths.
Michael Simkin in a room for 5 years figuring this one out.
So there we go.
That is fascinating.
It is amazing, though. Yeah.
And just to throw this in just before we finish, it's 199 years to the day since Edward Jenner died. So Edward Jenner, Mr. Vaccine.
Oh, Mr. Vaccine. What important these days.
What would he make of today, eh?
Yeah. It seems quite fitting that today is the anniversary, given that the number of boosters actually reached 1 million yesterday.
Oh, fantastic.
There you go.
Thank you, Edward Jenner. Thank you so much. And thank you, James Phipps, the 8-year-old boy that he did the trial on. Without his consent, of course. Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Raise a glass to James Phipps.
James Phipps, 8 years old. And he, I think Jenner gave him his house or something when he died as a thank you.
Oh,
but this
goodness.
Was an 8-year-old kid.
Did he, before he tested it on this 8-year-old child, did he test it on other things?
No, I don't think
just
so.
Just went
was,
straight
this,
to a person.
He was pretty sure this was going to work.
Yeah, it's going to work. We'll just see how it goes.
Wouldn't have passed the ethics.
No,
not at all.
No.
Great. Well, that wraps up Dear Science for another week. Thank you again very much to Alan for joining us.
Always a pleasure. And thank you, Motat.
Absolutely. Yes. Always thank you, Motat. We love you, Motat.
Yeah,
go and visit. They've got lots of awesome exhibitions on at the moment. You may have heard the ads. So if that's something that you want to get up to, go for it.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.